Good morning. My name is Michael McCusker. Today used to be Thanksgiving. That has been changed by Donald Trump, who tweeted an executive order early this morning that from here to eternity, today is to be known as National Patriotic Thank You Donald Trump Day. Under this order, everyone from today forward must be publicly thankful that Donald Trump is president by kowtowing three times a day, morning, noon, and night, facing the nearest Trump Tower. If more than one Trump Tower is in the vicinity, each American citizen is required to pay obeisance to each, however many points of the compass they must prostrate themselves. Indeed, Trump has pronounced that solely as a result of his own brilliant and supereminent magnificence, America is back. With a codicil that only his patron, Vladimir Putin, co-share his glory, twin rulers of the universe, so to speak. The other times the USA has claimed preeminence don't count. Most especially anything Barack Obama did was fake Muslim treachery. Obama-sama and Hillary Clinton are due to be arrested anytime soon. Don't think this assumed orgy of pompous imperialism might be far-fetched. Remember, Trump declared his inauguration National Patriotic Devotion Day. As the late Jimmy Breslin used to say, obviously with imprescient foresight, if you don't blow your own horn, there's no music. From the moment of Donald Trump's startling election, the most vocal and consistent concern has been his proximity to the nuclear trigger. The doomsday clock of the Association of Atomic Scientists was moved back to 2 minutes to midnight on Trump's inauguration day, for the first time since the end of the Cold War, nearly three decades ago. The fact that Trump, as president, can unilaterally unleash America's nuclear arsenal without any checks or balances horrifies quite a few, including top military brass, who must comply with his orders. One general says he will not obey an unlawful order to destroy the world, which presupposes a corollary question of what exactly would constitute a lawful order to obliterate humanity. Another possibility is a megalomaniac's wet dream. If this self-imagined master of the world has to die, so will everybody else. To be able to exterminate the human species is supreme power at its maximum, although a major drawback to his bloated vanity is that no one would be left to be impressed, and no Sarah Huckabee Sanders to extol or alibi this huge, one-time-only, total genocide. Today's program is a past-tense reprise of my first Thanksgiving radio rant on KMUN 30 years ago, which might be thought of as nuclear nostalgia. So if you will, momentarily suspend your reawakened anxieties of nearly forgotten Cold War dread and meander down memory lane to the familiar good times of duck and cover, mutual assured destruction, popularly known by its acronym, MAD, and acceptable levels of civilian casualties. I call it my radio nukemare. 30 years ago today, I tried to imitate Orson Welles' Halloween broadcast of 1938. I conceived of a live, on-the-radio annihilation fantasy. Instead of invasion from planet Mars, I projected a nuclear fiction of the final holocaustic triumph of war god, Mars. Although it didn't raise any of the fear and panic caused by Orson Welles' theatrical interpretation of H.G. Welles' book, War of the Worlds, the two Welleses were not related, it yet startled a few people who thought I should have warned them with a disclaimer before I ruined their Thanksgiving appetites. It was not my intent to ruin anybody's day of gluttony, but simply to pepper the sauce with an unsavory taste of mass genocide. Listeners might remember that 1987 was at the height of the Cold War, which politically peaked soon after. That was the year Helen Patty purchased the old house that has been KMUN since. Rumors were that the 19th century residence had been a brothel in Astoria's glory days. Volunteers did a remarkable remake. I remember starting the program that day with a long silence, dead air it is grimly called in the broadcast cloud. Then I said that only moments before, AM radio news had broadcast that Seattle and Portland had been nuked. That station went dead, and I said that I wasn't sure if KMUN was still broadcasting. I asked if anyone was listening. I read from a script I had written on a legal-sized yellow pad. I tried to emote the feeling that I didn't know what to think, sitting alone in a rural, coastal radio, public radio station, momentarily shocked beyond despair. I whimpered into the microphone that I had been thinking of living for years yet, that I wasn't prepared to realize my life had shortened to maybe only days or minutes if a missile with Astoria's address was on the way. But I thought Astoria would be a last shot for anybody launching expensive missiles. On the other hand, I wondered if an ICBM was that moment in the ozone arcing down to kiss the mouth of the Columbia River. I said my wish was that a nuclear war not occur until after I was dead. I thought humanity should be spared a nuclear war, but that my particular concern was that I be spared. After me, I said, the world would have to look after itself. I said that I felt numb and unsure, whole, untouched, on what might very well have been a dying planet. I marveled that Earth, in just an instant, had become one big rotting fruit. I thought squeamishly of the astronomical stench of several billion human beings and God knows how many dead dogs and cats, birds, pigs, horses, and cows would be killed and rotting by a nuclear war. Not a very friendly atmosphere, I said. Then I worried when all of us would start dying, a few days or weeks if a missile didn't drop on us. I knew I would soon be sick from radiation very soon, vomiting and evacuating at the end of the world. Uncontrollable diarrhea and death. All of us dead in our beds. Where else would we go at the end of the world, I said. Most of us to our clean houses with gardens and mowed lawns. If I hadn't already ruined your Thanksgiving by then, and your radio was still tuned to KMUN, I started pondering the prospects of nuclear war. We all knew it could happen someday, I said. Even if the Cold War ended and the doomsday priests proclaimed mourning in the nuclear age. That was the point. We remain living in the nuclear age forever. But we always hoped that someday was someday after tomorrow, that it wouldn't ever someday be today, I said. We tried to beat time. We raced against the juggernaut of inevitability, I said. Too few voices against so many missiles. So many Daddy Warbucks making big bucks off their big bangs. We were reasonable, I said, obeyed the law, let the government put us in jail if we defaced a missile or tried to stop the trucks, trains, or boats carrying nukes. Our reasonableness doomed us. Our little squeals of terror probably amused the nuke lords. Then I thought of the great movie Dr. Strangelove, the absurdity, the illogic of world suicide. We were all afraid of what nuclear weapons might do to us, but we made ourselves helpless to stop the madness of building so many of them they can blow up Earth a dozen times. Too many swallowed the nonsense that God's will determined our future. And in the meantime, I said, we split atoms like peas and built enough missiles to nuke every condo and grass shack on the planet. After that bon mot, I postulated what, for me, passes as philosophical pessimism. We were on our way out anyway, I said. The slow genetic burn of radiation since 1945. All those lies about acceptable levels. There aren't any acceptable levels. And all they talk about are single sources and specific effects. Hardly anyone mentions the cumulative evolutionary damage down the line. Or about the other combinations that bombard our bodies and genes, industrial pollutants, pesticides, radiation from nuclear power plants, tobacco smoke. I mentioned my hope for prevailing westerly winds to blow the radiation over the mountains, though I knew full well the winds would go around the world and come back at us across the Pacific Ocean. But if we were lucky, the radiation would dissipate. Storms could blow it south or north of here. Anywhere but here, I prayed. Anyone else but me. I thought that if any of us could live long enough, our offspring might tolerate radiation better, like flies got used to DDT, but we never have. Little chance we would, actually, but 1,000,000 to 1 chances might be all any of us would have left if this encore radio scenario ever does come to pass. Here is more of my doomsday cacography. It's a good chance that civilization would be over for a while if everybody that has a nuke used it. Back to savagery, I said. Of course, world suicide, blowing everything we've ever done back to the Stone Age, is savagery of a monumental form. Everything quickly, or more likely, gradually, coming apart and not getting fixed. Pretty soon, nobody remembers how to fix anything. The digital world we were just emerging into simply vanishes. Or how to build anything. And worse, no new ideas. Maybe we're smarter than that and can build a reasonable replacement civilization quickly, like after most wars. But sometimes in history, the light goes out. A nuclear war can put the lights out for a long time, maybe forever. If radiation didn't get us, we would soon run out of food and uncontaminated water. Most food we eat here on the Oregon North Coast and Washington South Coast comes from inland cities by truck, and most of the roads would probably be blasted. Local farm and dairy products would not last. Neither would farm stock, dairy cows especially. The only major food producer on the coast is Tillamook cheese. Massive looting and constipation. Oh, the horror. Pretty soon, after a nuke hit Portland or Seattle, city people would be scurrying to the coast. The coastal mountains might slow them, but it wouldn't take them long to cross over and then get past barricades and roadblocks set up by locals to stop them. We would be crowded by strangers with dwindling cash, idle and hungry, and most of them without shelter. Raging violent mobs would soon attack locals and clean out their homes and stores. Eventually, we might all degenerate into vicious little groups that attempt to rule with terror and murder and fight like street gangs with other vicious groups. I look out the studio window, I said. Astoria is still Astoria, unchanged, untouched, so far. And thus, I ended my first Thanksgiving program on KMUN 30 years ago today. A few phone calls were understandably irritable. A friend said it was the first time he ever checked real-time reality by a football game. And now, by Dr. Robert Brake, Bittersweet. It is Thanksgiving Day, and I am thinking about bittersweet. Not bittersweet items like cranberries or string beans, but the many bittersweet events during the first 10 months of the Trump administration. So let's talk turkey about what the Donald has done to demonize and demoralize us, while often inspiring us, sometimes at the same time. For example, while his pathetic crusade to gut Obamacare proved woefully unsuccessful, he did motivate millions of Americans to become better informed and enroll in the program. Bittersweet indeed. His attacks on women motivated 1,000,000 marchers to protest on the day of his inauguration. His Muslim ban, issued just 7 days after his inauguration, motivated concerned Americans to reconsider the import of E Pluribus Unum, out of many, one, the motto of the United States. Once again, Americans tuned in to the riveting message of Kizar and Ghazala Khan, a Gold Star family whom Trump denigrated after the loss of their son, Captain Humayun Khan, in Iraq. Trump's hugely reckless June 1st declaration to pull out of the Paris Climate Accord infuriated millions of us who now vow to do whatever we can to protect our planet. During his visit to Puerto Rico after the hurricane, Trump declared that Maria wasn't a real disaster, quote-unquote, like Hurricane Katrina in 2005. Our would-be meteorologist displayed no empathy for the 3.2 million brown-skinned Puerto Ricans who had no power or water or much of anything necessary to survive. How sad. But millions of Americans tried to help with cash, donations, prayer, or whatever they could muster. Trump's failure to condemn the white supremacists at the August 12th Charlottesville protest left a bitter taste, since there was no evidence that there were leftist terrorists or fine people on both sides, both things he said. His unwillingness to disassociate from Nazis and white power demonstrators, whose violence left one anti-Nazi protester dead and many injured, energized millions of citizens who value diversity and tolerance. Toss in Trump's election of racist Attorney General Jeff Sessions, and, well, you get the picture. Trump is clearly bigoted and incapable of registering even a scintilla of tolerance for people who are different. Witness his reaction to the death of Army Sergeant LaDavid Johnson, killed in Niger on October 4, 2017. POTUS seemed to discount the death since the sergeant, quote, knew what he signed up for, unquote. How pathetic, especially when Trump tried to explain his failure to personally contact Johnson's pregnant widow, Myesha, who claimed that Trump couldn't even remember her dead husband's name. No empathy there, since Trump's only real priority is always what's in it for Trump. The issue of NFL players kneeling during the playing of the national anthem prompted Trump to beat the drum for real patriotism, even though Colin Kaepernick and others who knelt were not trying to overthrow the government, but were expressing their deep concern for racial justice in the land of the free and the home of the brave. Trump is a pathological liar, as evidenced by evil media like the New York Times that printed a list of all of Trump's tweeted or otherwise stated lies between January 20th and June 25th, 2017. The list required an entire page in very small print. But Trump's skirmishes with facts and truth-telling has inspired millions of Americans, millions of us Americans, to mobilize to outmaneuver our egocentric, dim-bulb, short-fingered, Bulgarian POTUS. Finally, consider what Trump has done to the English language, savagely mauling it, incapable of stringing words together in a coherent sentence. Trump has created such mass confusion that his struggle to find the right words seems like a drunk driver smashing into a truck loaded with alphabet soup. Consider this example among many of Trump's dazzling incoherence. Quote, you look at the nuclear deal, the thing that really bothers me. It would have been so easy, and it's not. As important as these lives are, nuclear is so powerful. My uncle explained that to me many, many years ago, the power, and that was 35 years ago. He would explain the power of what's going to happen, and he was right. Who would have thought? End quote. And the staggeringly futile rambling continues for several more minutes. Can you imagine the headaches Trump speak induces as translators struggle to convert the Donald's words into a foreign language? Hashtag number 45 has reminded us that President Barack Obama had a way with words. It is just as obvious that Trump not have way. Nonetheless, since listening to Trump talk is such a dizzying experience, many of us realize that we need to pursue candor, clarity, and concision in order to combat the deleterious effect of Trump's rhetoric. We all need to use language to effectively mobilize our dissent, and hundreds of groups have already organized to do that. There you have it, my short list of Trump behaviors, paradoxically, that have created some real bittersweet moments. I haven't even examined ongoing controversies like the Russia probe, fake news, alternative facts, Betsy DeVos, transgender, military personnel, and a treasure trove of other topics. After all, a story told is only a half-hour program, and I'm on my way to engorge in some tasty, albeit bittersweet foods and beverages. So I am temporarily setting aside my bittersweet thoughts. Happy Turkey Day, everyone. And that was by Robert Brake, Bittersweet. He lives in Ocean Park, Washington, and is a retired teacher and active writer for the Chinook Observer, which he often passes on for broadcast on this program, which is still listed as A Story Told. And now, something again that I wrote, Death of a President. The youngest American president, John F. Kennedy, was assassinated 54 years ago yesterday, on Friday, November 22, 1963. He was the 35th president and the fourth assassinated, though not the last intended. He was not the best or brightest president of the USA, yet he had a remarkable capacity to engender belief in him. Norman Mailer called him Superman at the supermarket. A myth grew up around him of a mythic and fanciful Camelot he and his glamorous and intellectually gifted wife Jacqueline created at the previously dull and drab White House. His term lasted less than 3 years. His record is controversial, as was his private life. Though not everyone regards his short reign with favor, he was remembered for the most part kindly and with a national nostalgia for a lost youth. In other places in the world, his photograph continues to hang next to Lincoln's as the two good American presidents, both of whom were assassinated by persons of a different opinion. Was Kennedy murdered by a lone assassin? No one is certain or satisfied with official explanation. Conspiracy theories are a growth market still, and especially now resurfacing with the promise that the present president has made of releasing the entire record. Nearly 30 other deaths surround his, which many believe significant to a conspiracy, though official history dismisses them as coincidence. Almost everyone still alive from then remembers with clarity where they were and what they were doing the instant they learned the president was killed in Dallas, Texas. Bubbles of private identity burst immediately, converging into public mourning and apprehension. People still want to know what happened and only half believe official history. Release of the Warren Commission transcripts 30 years after the assassination offered little that was new or changed long-held opinions. The public still awaits release of the final assassination records that were promised to be made wholly public on the 50th anniversary in 2013. The promise hasn't been entirely broken, just trickled down with many parts censored. It should be mentioned that JFK's younger brother Robert was assassinated 5 years later on June 5, 1968, a bonus year for political killings. This time, a Kennedy was killed before he became president. Perhaps somebody didn't want RFK to be president. One theory at the time was that RFK would have access to the records of his brother's assassination. Think about it. If RFK had not been shot, there probably would not have been the presidencies of Nixon, who it appears betrayed the country to be elected at the cost of about 30,000 more Americans killed in Vietnam and maybe a million or more Vietnamese civilians, or Reagan, Bush's 41 and 43, and most repressingly, the most regressive and menacing of all, Donald Trump. And we might have had a woman president a long time ago. Perhaps Shirley Chisholm or Barbara Jordan could have also been the first black president. On a subjective note, I went to work for my first real newspaper job the weekend JFK was killed as a 22-year-old copy boy at the Pasadena Independent Star News. So this is also a personal anniversary. I am also, as was the accused assassin, an ex-U.S. Marine. I must admit to a certain snarky delight that Lee Harvey Oswald, despite repatriating to Russia as a communist sympathizer following his discharge, then returning to the USA perhaps from disillusion, and despite subsequent disassociation by the USMC, he will most likely be the most famous Marine in history for his infamous act. And as epilogue, once again, this country is being torn apart by its past, which is misconceived and twisted into self-serving fantasies and prejudices of enduring opposing ideologies. Abraham Lincoln spoke at Gettysburg on November 19, 1863, with nearly psychic clarity of our own contemporary anxieties about the contradictions between democracy and fascism, when he said that our revolutionary ancestors, quote, brought forth on this continent a new nation conceived in liberty and dedicated to the proposition that all human beings are created equal. Now we are engaged in a great civil war, testing whether that nation or any other nation so conceived and so dedicated can long endure. That government of the people, by the people, for the people, shall not perish from the earth. That's great civil war he spoke of has never ended, nor probably ever will, as long as human beings are themselves the contradictory beings they have been since dropping out of trees in Africa, of all places, whose black descendants were brought to this continent as slaves, but were freed, contradictorily, by primarily white suffragists and soldiers, who primarily despised slavery, but most of whom were also racists and racial separatists. The Trump maladministration insists on the literal disenfranchisement of the majority of Americans economically and politically in favor of the filthy rich few. Our history is being disrupted and despoiled by wealthy classes who seem to ascribe to pre-revolution forms of aristocracy and medieval-style serfdom for the common citizenry, who must, of course, pay the taxes and fight the wars, as in the good old days Trump is zealous to emulate. It might be noted that Lincoln revived Thanksgiving as a national holiday that same year he spoke at Gettysburg. George Washington had inaugurated it after the Revolution, but it fell into sporadic local observances. And to answer Sarah Huckabee Sanders' snide question to reporters at the White House Thanksgiving press conference a couple of days ago, what were they thankful for? I am thankful that women all over the country are courageously and publicly confronting prominent and powerful men who have sexually abused them, whether yesterday or 40 years ago. They are refusing to remain silent any longer about abuse and victimization, which includes overt rape and serial sexual predation, and their demands to be taken seriously echo through the culture. It is unfortunate for the country that the president is a serial sex offender and boasts about it, but each accusation circles closer to ground zero, the national sex predator-in-chief, who is also under investigation for probable treachery. This is Michael McCusker. I dedicate today's program to two people who each died on Thanksgiving. To a young woman I knew only as Black Joyce, a resident client of Coast Rehab, who died of a heart attack on Thanksgiving 1991. And to Jim Josie, an Army veteran of Vietnam, who committed suicide in Portland Thanksgiving 1978. "When you are in a war," he said, "you are already dead."